What's up, QAA listeners?
The fun and games have begun.
I found a way to connect to the internet. I'm sorry, boy.
Welcome, listener, to Premium Chapter 163 of the QAnon Anonymous Podcast, the America's Army, the real Ender's Game episode. As always, we are your hosts, Jake Rokitansky,
Julian Fields,
and Travis View.
Welcome, folks. Today, I'm in a bit of a pickle as the person writing this intro because Jake has chosen to cover America's Army, the video game where you basically learn to love and respect America's beautiful troops, and to maybe even want to partake and leave your gamer chair and go and, you know, serve. Today, I'm going to be highly respectful of this entire thing. None of these words, you know, should be taken with a sarcastic tone because I am in jeopardy. And Father America must look benevolently on me or things in my life are not going to go great in the next couple weeks. So I'm in a vulnerable state. I feel like shit. I said Jake when it came to saying my name. And I don't know what to tell you, folks. It's going to be quite an episode, and put your patriotic boots on, and let's get this fucking show on the road.
America's Army.
The year is 2002. You, an enthusiastic gamer, armed with a Koopa Shell backpack, have braved LA traffic and arrived at the convention center nestled square in the heart of the downtown area. The purpose? To attend gaming's most hyped-up event, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, otherwise known as E3.
We once went there together.
We did.
And you just had a massive panic attack and ran away. It was a swishy shorts situation.
How could I have had, looking back on it now, I'm like, that's the greatest place in the world. Like, how could I have had a panic attack there?
No, you were freaking out. Like, we hadn't even made it in. You were freaking the fuck out. I think you had, like, a bad coffee or something.
I probably had, like, major imposter syndrome because we essentially kind of, like, wormed our way.
Hey, we fucking got press passes fair and square based on this
we
website
were press
I put together.
Fair and square, but it was kind of a worming, if I'm going
to
be honest.
Hey, man, I had a great time. I got to see the presentation of Civilization 6 and get a little pen.
I went and saw Ubisoft demo Steep, which was their skiing and snowboarding game. And I remember turning to one of the developers like who was like watching me play and being like, oh, good, you guys added like the tail slide on the right stick. That's good. That's accurate.
Anyways, apologies for derailing. The year is 2002. A reminder, let's go back.
Perhaps you attended the 2002 E3 to maybe catch a glimpse of Doom 3, id Software's much-anticipated sequel to the beloved franchise. Or maybe you attended in hopes of getting some hands-on time with Metroid Prime. But as you stroll up to the grand doors of the convention center, something is wrong. You hear the loud call of a trumpet being played by a uniformed military officer. Suddenly, you're in the shadow of a large M1 Abrams tank parked outside the center. You thought you were here to sample the latest and greatest video games, but instead are thrust into a military outpost complete with armed personnel carriers and fully geared up US soldiers. A large banner framing the entire scene is flapping in the wind. It reads, America's Army. Before I get started, I wanted to cite the paper that I use for a lot of the primary research. It was written by Zan Lee, who has his master's in social anthropology from Cambridge University, and the paper's titled The Potential of America's Army, the Video Game as Civilian Military Public Sphere. Now, I'm going to be honest. This paper is kind of out of my education level. It was incredibly thorough. It was over 100 pages. Yeah. Liv, if you're listening to this episode, or perhaps I will message you privately. I want you to read the paper because I think you'd probably get more out of it than me. And it's just fascinating. The amount of interviews he does, he talked to all of the original game developers, all of the main players. I mean, went deep into the community. I mean, just a really fascinating paper. And we will link it in the show description.
Hey, Liv, could you just take a look at these 100 pages for me? Just so I can get it.
I think she would enjoy
it. No. We've already recorded the
episode. It out of because I think that she would find it interesting.
No, we already have the episode. It's already out. I just need, like, your point of view for kind of, like, posterity.
Yeah, just for fun, just as friends. That's all. What's wrong with that?
Nothing.
In the years following the first Gulf War, there was a growing manpower concern in the United States Army. Recruitment numbers just weren't what they used to be. From the late 1980s through the 1990s, the end of the Cold War had dropped recruitment numbers by 40%. Many in the public sphere were actually speaking out against the Gulf War and calling attention to the idea that the American military was actually occupiers as opposed to liberators. This would not do. The inception of America's army was predominantly triggered by a 1997 National Research Council report that suggested that video games were a far better networking tool than defense research expenditures. Essentially, that the gaming industry had such high demands that their technology at creating virtual worlds was far superior to DARPA's. In a YouTube seminar just last month, one of the original heads of America's Army, Mike Zaida, spoke about the military's newfound interest in video games.
The games industry was building larger networked environments than the military was, and it was building more accurately modeled 3D characters than the military was. And it was making very interesting strides into AI and machine learning technologies for AI characters in games. And the DARPA efforts were just a pale shadow of this. So this study was very important. It changed all of defense modeling and simulation to thinking about, we should build this with a game engine.
On top of this, you know, the Army was no stranger in, you know, getting its fingers into entertainment. They had been running commercials in movie theaters in the 30s and 40s. They have and continue to piggyback on Hollywood and the entertainment industry to push a pro-military agenda to young people. After this report came out, Mike Zaida, who was the founding director of the Modeling, Virtual Environments, and Simulation, otherwise known as MOVES program, at the Naval Postgraduate Academy, was tasked by the Assistant Secretary for the Army's Office of Economics, Manpower, and Reserves with coming up with a pitch for a U.S. government-funded video game. Zaida came in with a couple of slides, he pitched. The Army loved the pitch. He was then paired up with Colonel Casey Wardinsky, who was the director of West Point Academy's economic office. Wardinsky had watched his 17-year-old son spend hours in front of his computer screen playing Counter-Strike, so he was no stranger to how effective the medium could potentially be, at the very least, in holding young people's attention. What if the U.S. Army itself created a first-person shooter modeled after Counter-Strike that could kill two birds with one stone, improve civilian opinion about the military, and potentially encourage teenage males, the desired demographic, to enlist themselves? Now, what's crazy is that I would listen to this whole seminar with Mike Zaida, and he said that the age that the United States Army was looking to capture with this video game were males aged 11 to 14.
Whoa, that seems a little low. I mean, what do you do then? Wait for them to incubate?
Exactly. That you essentially for year, you know, from like 11 to 14, you get them obsessed with this game. And then for 4 years, you get them thinking about it so that by the time they turn 18, they're, you know, maybe leaning towards enlisting.
I think they underestimate how low our attention spans are at this point.
Well,
it's like by that point, you're just going to enlist in like Quake 2.
You'll see. Well, and that's what's really interesting, too. The game was, I can't remember if I say it later, but the game was built off the Unreal Engine. They actually used Unreal Tournament as the sort of base model for what the game was going to become, which is wild to me.
Yeah, considering that game, when people died, they, you know, frequently like broke apart in many sort of pixelated fragments. That's what I remember most about Unreal Tournament is the yeah, gruesome deaths when you actually did hit someone with a grenade or something.
Well, we'll get to this, but there actually is no gore in America's Army, and that is for a very specific purpose. Here's a quote from Colonel Wardinsky about how he viewed computers in terms of a possible recruitment tool.
The computer's a tool. I was looking for a medium which would be disruptive in nature and would shift the way people think about communication and army recruiting, dramatically shift the effectiveness, shift the cost, shift the intermediation. Computers tend to be persuasive by nature, seen as devices that are sort of unbiased, very analytic in nature. Computers just sitting there. It processes data and dumps out a result. It's very different from a recruiter. That's the hard sell. The game is very much a different kind of sell. It represents a virtual world where you can separate them from their real-world structure and take them elsewhere, i.e. the Army, and this gets rid of the intermediator problems.
Yeah, that's awesome. They're like, well, no, the recruiters have terrible personalities, and they often turn off the kids just by being jerks, but the video game can be programmed to not, like, sound weird and not, you know, feel coercive.
Yeah. Oh, it's the whole thing is so insidious. Just wait. So as it was, the Army was spending about $15,000 per soldier in recruitment. And Wardinsky was concerned that there was way too much competition for people's attention in this new digital age for traditional methods to have any effect.
Wardinsky was concerned that in an increasingly dense, diversified, and competitive popular culture media environment, the Army was insufficiently effective in communicating through its television and film advertising campaigns. The new digital generation of tech-savvy kids was demonstrating a marked trend away from traditional screens to computer network interactivity, in addition to higher expectations for information access. Wardinsky noted that if kids have stilted information or no information, the recruiting costs are going to go through the roof.
And so, America's Army was born. Wardinsky led the project alongside Mike Sida, and it was developed by the Naval Postgraduate School MOVES Institute in Monterey, California, using the Unreal 3 engine. I believe it was the first game that showed off the Unreal 3 engine.
Really?
Do not write in Gaming Nerds when he's false.
Yeah, it might be Unreal 2. It was late, but it was the newest.
The engine itself, you might have gotten wrong. Not even the statement that it was the first game on the engine. Uh-oh.
The goal was. The goal was to release an ultra-realistic military simulator that got gamers familiar with the Army's chain of command, the types of weapons it used, and the strategies it employed in combat scenarios. The game was granted a $5 million budget with $2 million per year to fund maintenance and updates. The crazy thing about all this to me was discovering not just that gamers were seen as an untapped resource by the United States military, but were also the exact kind of soldiers the Army was looking for. They saw online competitive shooter players as people who were used to the idea of making quick decisions under stress and focusing on strategy and teamwork. They knew how to operate computers and were familiar with gamepads and joysticks. Also, they knew how to read a HUD. This is from an article written about the game's development by our boy, journalist Gary Webb for the Sacramento News and Review. And spoiler alert, Gary Webb hates this game.
I'm surprised.
He writes,
quote, "Our military information tends to arrive in the flood. It'll arrive in the flood under stressful conditions, and there'll be a hell of a lot of noise," said Colonel Casey Wardinsky, a military economist who came up with the idea for an official Army computer game. Quote, "How do you filter that? What are your tools? What is your facility in doing that? What is your level of comfort? How much load can you bear? Kids who are comfortable with that are going to be real comfortable with the Army of the future."
Now to address their spines, I mean, they're still going to be like gamers, like with shitty scoliosis.
And then also in the article, Webb includes a quote from an official Army report that says, quote, "Aptitudes related to information handling and information culture values are seen as vital to the effectiveness of the high-tech, network-centric Army of the future, and young American gamers are seen as especially proficient in these capabilities. More importantly, when young Americans enter the Army, they increasingly will find that key information will be conveyed via computer video displays akin to the graphical interfaces found in games."
Fucking amazing, dude.
I just found this fascinating.
We would have won in Afghanistan, but we couldn't find the next respawn point.
Yeah, they didn't know how to choose their loadout properly. They were stuck in the squad join screen.
Ah, fuck, I can't see anything. The whole thing is, I'm clipping through D-dust Afghanistan, and we just lost 100 troops.
The game launched on July 4th, 2002. In the wake of 9/11, the Army realized there was general support for the armed forces by both the public and the press, and decided that they should launch the game and strike while the iron was hot. Some of the developers were initially concerned that the public would object to a government-funded game that encouraged teenagers to shoot terrorists, but as it turned out, it wasn't really an issue.
Maybe their brains aren't soft enough for this, Gary.
Mike Zaida is quoted as saying, "We thought we'd have a lot more problems, but the country is in this mood where anything the military does is great. 9/11 sort of assured the success of this game.
Oh my God.
I'm not sure what kind of reception it would have received otherwise."
Holy shit, man. He said it. He said it.
He said it. He said the quiet part loud. The game was announced at E3, and in addition to the tanks and uniformed soldiers parked out front of the LA Convention Center that I mentioned in the beginning of the episode, the military conducted an entire presentation on the convention floor where fucking Special Forces units rappelled down through the roof from a hovering Black Hawk helicopter. I shit you not. You can find this on YouTube. There's a whole video. It doesn't work for podcasts because it's just fucking chopper sounds and people running around, but it is insane.
The Army had an opportunity to napalm all the main gamers. And they decided to do a little show for them. Good job, Army. You clearly don't understand the threat.
So the soldiers hit the ground and they moved out in formation past the convention goers with guns drawn. Yes, you can find it. You can find the video of it online, and it is absolutely insane.
Just double tapping like random nerds.
Yeah, they're like standing in like defensive position. Like there's one guy with like a fucking sniper rifle, like laying prone, like with his gun aimed at like all these convention goers. It's absolutely insane.
Accidentally canoeing a Zelda fan.
You may or may not be surprised to discover that America's Army won Best in Show at E3 that year. But it almost didn't happen. According to Zyda, the Army wanted full approval before anyone knew the game existed. They wanted to see the game, play it themselves in a classified environment to ensure that nothing in the game would make the Army look bad in any way. When it finally did release, many mainstream journalists actually wrote puff pieces about the game. Here's a quote from a Salon.com article written by Wagner James O, who had this to say about the future soldiers who got their start with America's Army. "You can see them in the field in subsequent years, dedicated young men and women, their weapons merged into an information network that enables them to cut out with surgical precision the cancer that threatens us all. Heat-packing humanitarians who leave the innocent unscathed and full of renewed hope. In their wake, democracy, literacy, and an Arab world return to full flower as it deserves to be, an equal in a burgeoning global culture defended on all fronts by the best of the digital generation."
Okay, I'm just like, why don't they have the state media labels for these people at this point? Just give them the fucking same labels you give to RT. Let's just fucking admit that somehow, even if you think you're free, you are like encased in a giant gelatinous vat that is controlling your fucking mind and making you write this kind of shit. This is one of the most disgusting passages I've ever had to hear on this show, and I fucking hate you, Jake.
Oh man.
My God. The idea that in the wake of them, democracy, literacy, and an Arab world restored to full flower. Oh yes, the feminized flower of the Arab world turned rough by the sands of the desert. But fear not, the gamers will canoe their way through and make sure that humanitarians are, well, it's precision, the cancer that threatens us all of the Arab mind. My God, my Lord. I was supposed to be patriotic. I fucked up. It's fucking 26 minutes in and I'm fucked, boys. You're never going to see me again. I'm going to get black bagged.
This is why Julian doesn't let me take the helm on episodes very often, because I'm always guaranteed to bring him a brain rot. The game was a massive success.
Thank God.
It quickly became one of the top 5 competitive shooters online, and over 500 internet communities sprung up around it. Gamers loved that the gameplay was objective-based, like Counter-Strike, but used way more realistic weapons and relied even more heavily on teamwork. The other thing, it was totally free.
My God.
So nowadays, of course, the free-to-play model is well-known throughout the gaming industry. So one might say that the Army was ahead of their time.
Oh my God, oh my God. Guys, microtransactions and you can get a purple heart in the game. We figured it out, boys. We're going to fund the Army and recruit.
And, you know, maybe they were ahead of their time, but for way more insidious reasons than even the monetization of loot boxes and skins. The Army wanted to keep the game free for 2 reasons. This is fucking insane. One, they believed it represented the Army's highest regarded principle, freedom. But there was a second reason as well. By making the game free to download off the internet, the Army believed that just the act of getting the game to run required a bit of computer knowledge and savviness. It was essentially the player's first official test.
Worst cicada ever, where you're like, I don't get it. The DLL is missing and I fucking can't make the drivers work.
Yeah, exactly. Now, things get crazy from here. With the game's success, a lot of the higher-ups in the military were beginning to take notice. They began to wonder what other implications the software could have. About a year into production, the Army cut out the Naval Postgraduate School as the developers, citing differences in opinion as to what direction the game would go. Now, there was a reason that the Army wanted full control over the game. Its graphics were way better than any of the current Army simulators.
Well, also, the Navy wanted to build in a gay sex on a ship module to it.
Julian, that's not going to get you into the country.
I'm fucked, boys. Just carry me out to the ocean. Just fucking drown me in the waves. I'm so sick of this fucking island, man.
The developers had done way too good a job, and just allowing it to be merely a recruitment tool would be a waste of precious military funds. The game, or some version of it, was deployed across multiple branches of the military, including the Secret Service. In terms of the game's future development, the United States Army contracted French developer Ubisoft, who would continue to update the game and port it to both Xbox and PlayStation as well, which makes perfect sense. I went full, by the way, like baking, like classic Jake conspiracy theory when I was like, oh my God, it all makes sense. Ubisoft has only made like military shooter games like since then. Like they are in league with the United States Army, but like the Army branding isn't on the Ubisoft games. They're just putting it out. Like I went insane thinking about this. I have no proof of that, by the way. That's just my own.
Listen, man, Guillermo, you're right though. He's definitely an asset.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the military literally has an entertainment media liaison office. So, I mean, it's not crazy to think that, you know, they at least have their fingers, at least to some extent, in the military shooters that are produced.
Is that like the Nintendo hotline where you can call and get like maybe a cheat code for the game where the Arabs don't fight back?
let's think about a couple Ubisoft titles here. Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon, Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell, Tom Clancy's The Division, Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon, the two newest ones, Breakpoint and Wildlands.
Siege.
All video games that have realistic military weapons where you're a soldier, quote-unquote, liberating an island filled with brown people.
Yeah, but so, you're kind of describing every... I mean, then we have to do COD, then we have to do... There's so many others that are... They're all
yeah,
like blatantly.
You're right. It's all the same.
Pro-military.
You're right. I take it back, Ubisoft. I still love you. I thought the latest Watch Dogs could have been better, but you know what? That's on me.
You could pretty much say any of their game like franchises, and that would apply.
Yeah. On November 6th of 2003, the Army released its first major update to the game and changed the title to America's Army Special Forces. The game was essentially the same,
yes,
except that it added Special Forces weapons and gear and a handful of maps that closely resembled real Special Forces operations. This, of course, was because the Army's internal data showed that the number of Special Forces recruits was way below what they hoped for. So here we have them, like, releasing an update to the game and changing the title because they're like, oh, well, you know, we'll change it to Special Forces, we'll add some of their weapons because, like, we need more Special Forces guys.
Yeah, it's also cooler. Like, they're realizing, wait a second, if I'm a grunt, I get, like, two weapons max, maybe just one. I want the full gear. I want to get into the Black Hawks. I want to run the op on fucking, you know, Bin Laden.
All right, let's get into the actual gameplay. When America's Army was being developed, the Army's primary objective was to get gamers comfortable with many aspects of enlisted life. Before you are allowed to even play a match, each player must go through basic training.
The other players are in a lobby and they take a sock and they put soap in it and they beat the shit out of you. And then you can connect.
There's an obstacle course, there are drill sergeants yelling at you, this is all by design. And you cannot play the actual game unless you pass a shooting exercise. Colonel Casey Wardinsky was interviewed in a 2005 Washington Post article written by Josh White, and he explained how the game was helping young men find the confidence to become a soldier in real life.
Quote, "We want kids to come into the Army and feel like they've already been there," said Colonel Casey Wardinsky, who, as director of the Army's Office of Economic and Manpower Analysis, came up with the idea. Quote, "A game is like a team effort, and the Army is very much a team effort. By playing an online multiplayer game, you can get the feel of being in the Army."
This is amazing because the people at the top are playing an RTS, but you're playing an FPS.
Yes, that's why it's fucking Ender's Game. It is Ender's Game. Just wait. Oh, just wait. Just wait. Oh, it gets so much better.
It's designed to give them an inside view of the very fundamentals of being a soldier. And it's also designed to give them a sense of self-efficacy that they can do it, Wardinsky said. Players start out completing obstacle courses and learning how to fire realistic army weapons, such as automatic rifles and grenade launchers. Quote, "We want them to see that they can succeed in doing this. You don't have to think what it would look like. You can see what it looks like."
So they just want to build the confidence. They just want young teenagers, 11 to 14, to know that they can aim down the sights and they can get a headshot. You know, they want to build that confidence.
Yes.
Players were shocked to discover that if you got bored and, say, turned your gun on one of the drill sergeants, you were locked up in a virtual Leavenworth prison where you would have to wait in a timeout before getting to take another crack at the obstacle course.
Oh, no. You cannot become Pyle, okay? Do not go full Pyle.
You want to build up the confidence to know that you can tolerate the, you know, the consequences of being a convicted war criminal.
Yeah, get your yellow stripe.
Yeah.
Now the game wouldn't put you in jail. It would just start a different simulator. It would be like a conservative talk show host.
Or it would, like, they would reassign you to a different venue.
Yes. I didn't write this in the episode, but actually, Julian, you're kind of right. One of the things that they did was they created two different kinds of servers. There were servers where players could use cheat codes, infinite ammo, higher jumps, that sort of stuff, so that the players who did want to fuck around, they had a place that was provided by the actual game to go in and do that, so that they could separate the communities between like the people that wanted to play realistically and teamwork and the people that wanted to like fuck around and team kill.
Sir, we've got the data in after 3 months of playtesting. It turns out that we need to give our troops both double jump and infinite ammo. So let's look at that, how that's going to look in the field.
The game also employed an honor system that was patterned after the real military's code of conduct. Work well with your teammates and utilize proper strategy, your honor goes up. Team kill and harass other players, your honor goes down. If a player's honor level reached zero, they were booted from the game permanently.
Seppuku. Fall on your sword, soldier. You're just too twisted.
Also, there is like this like weird thing in the community of America's Army players that like, when they see like a player who has like really, really high honor, they're like, oh, fuck that guy. He's a loser. Like, oh, but if you had like there was a fine line between like not having enough honor
right.
and having too much honor within the community. It's wild.
Yeah. You want the like weird gang tattoos, but you don't want to be the main war criminal.
Lee had this to say about the game's feature in his paper. Quote, "These game design features promote a positive public image of the Army, but were also intended to counter criticisms of the game. The press kit FAQs produced by the Social and Political Sciences academic staff at OEMA, that's the Office of Economic and Manpower Analysis, deal extensively with answering a range of potential criticism that accuse the game of promoting wanton violence, of militarizing youth culture, of potentially damaging the image of the U.S. Army, and even helping to train enemies of the United States." Quote, this is from the Army. "The Army game encourages America's democratic ideals in the application of military force. The United States is highly regarded abroad for its respect for the rule of law." "The Army's game embodies this respect for rule of law by incorporating rules of engagement and the laws of war into gameplay. The game penalizes players who fail to abide by these rules. Furthermore, the game provides insights into the Army as an organization based upon a set of noble values. We are not concerned that hostile entities might play the game. Indeed, if they did, they would discover that American soldiers operate within a value-laden organization. Perhaps they might even identify with these values and question their hostility to the United States."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you're in a foreign country, you maybe think like the U.S. military is like maybe not such great guys. You can play the game and come out being like, you know what? Like, what do I even hate these guys for? I mean, they're so noble.
I fell off my scooter the other day, and I'm all bruised up, and my ribs are fucked, and this is worse.
Did you really fall off?
Yeah, unfortunately, it was wet out.
Oh, you slid?
We slid out almost at a stop. We were coming to a stop around a corner, and it was so wet. And it, we,
oh,
we just...
no, Mathilde was on too?
Yeah, she's okay, even better than okay. me. I'm kind of doinked up.
Oh, man, sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's just good stuff happening these days, just great.
Good, well, you'll like the rest of the episode.
Cool.
The developers didn't want the game to receive a mature rating, as that would alienate many of the under-18 gamers they were desperate to reach. They made the decision to not include any gore whatsoever into the gameplay, but instead have tiny clouds of red mist to indicate a bullet had struck its target. On the other hand, however, they worked with a team of military psychologists to adjust the sounds in the game to specifically raise the heartbeat of the player and get their adrenaline pumping. If you take away all of the propaganda, the game itself is a slightly slower version of Counter-Strike. The physics are much more realistic, incorporating bullet drop and a much lower time to kill, but the loop essentially remains the same. Work with your team to escort a VIP or defuse a bomb, etc. None of the gameplay modes are centered around eliminate the opposing team. It's all objective-based, and rounds typically last less than a couple of minutes. Oh, and there's also this. When you play America's Army, you will never, ever be able to kill American soldiers. They've programmed it so the enemy team always looks like terrorists, and your team always looks like the good guys. I thought this was fascinating. I did not know this. The terrorists are from a made-up Middle Eastern country, and despite them having diverse skin colors, this was a specific choice made by the developers, they almost always have beards.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in America's Army, none of the weapons are gated, meaning every single weapon is available to the player right away. The reason for this is that the Army has access to every single second of gameplay since its release, and they were actively assessing each player to see if there was a particular function they excelled in. This is also from the web article.
Quote, suppose you played extremely well and you stayed in the game an extremely long time, Wardinsky explained in an interview last year. You might just get an email seeing if you'd like any additional information on the Army. America's Army isn't merely a game, recruiting device, or a public relations tool, though it is certainly all of those things. It's also a military aptitude tester, and it was designed that way from the start. In a paper written while he was still developing the game, Navy computer expert Zaida said that, quote, the research focus is to determine if games can be instrumental to be able to determine the aptitude, leadership abilities, and psychological profile of the game player.
Webb also noted that if you dig around deep enough on the America's Army website, you will find this fine print.
Players who request information about the Army may have their gaming records matched to their real-world identities for the purpose of facilitating career placement within the Army. Data collected within the game, such as which roles and missions players spent the most time playing, could be used to highlight Army career fields that map into these interest areas. Oh boy.
So yeah, it's basically Ender's Game. Do well in the game, and the Army will collect data from your matches so it knows where to stick you if and when you decide to enlist. I guess I kind of assumed this was happening, but it's weird to see them fully admit to it.
It seems like it's more like The Last Starfighter, right? But except it's about a ground military rather than a sort of an extraterrestrial spacecraft.
True.
It's like if you beat the game, you finally get to the last level, you shoot Bin Laden in the head, and then Army recruiter rolls up in a Humvee to your house and asks what kind of job you'd like.
Well, it's funny that you mention that, Travis, because America's Army was so successful, the military began setting up live experiences at theme parks and NASCAR races to capitalize on it further. Teenagers are funneled into a 12,000-square-foot inflatable dome and are taken through various stages of simulation. First, there's a 12-computer LAN room where visitors can face off against their friends in the actual game itself. Then the players are ushered into a briefing room where a real soldier gives them mission objectives before they jump on a giant Humvee with mounted machine guns. A special version of the game is displayed on a 180-degree screen, and players embark on a driving mission, shooting terrorists along the road with their mounted weapons. Journalist Peter Thorne was invited to attend one of these pop-up events and documented his experience.
It is fast-paced.
Uh-huh.
It's action-packed and very high-tech. Kind of a video game, but not just a game. It's the Army's new tool to recruit young people, and you can find it in an amusement park.
It's marketed as a virtual test drive of the U.S. Army, where players get to ride along on a simulated Army mission. And it's the subject of tonight's Fact Finders Report. Here's Peter Thorne. Peter.
Well, there is a war, but there is no draft, so an all-volunteer Army has to recruit. Part of that recruiting effort is something you will see here only on 11. It's called the Virtual Army Experience, touring the country with little fanfare for the past year and a half, hoping to educate the public about what the Army does, and when it was recently in our area, I was offered an inside look.
The phenomenon started here, with America's Army, the U.S. Army's official video game designed to boost recruiting in the internet age. And now every gamer's wish. This video game has jumped off the computer screen and into the real world. Right here at Six Flags Great Adventure Amusement Park in New Jersey is a high-tech combat simulator modeled on a video game. called the Virtual Army Experience, we saw long lines of teenagers eager to get in, grab a gun, and start shooting.
Strad's gonna be sick.
After getting their picture taken, providing age, address, phone number, and email, players wind up here, inside this massive 10,000 square foot air-conditioned inflatable hangar.
I want to welcome you guys to the Virtual Army Experience.
The goal? To educate the curious about what the Army really offers, and bring civilians as close to a real combat mission as you can get without being in Baghdad. Up to 50 players at a time start with an intelligence briefing on their mission.
Soldiers, you are part of an Army task force.
We divide into teams. I take position with my unit atop a modified Army Humvee, bristling with Mach M249 machine guns. There's also another Humvee in the corner and a modified Black Hawk helicopter. Within seconds, the ear-splitting, eye-popping mission starts.
This mission's rules of engagement: don't fire on civilians, don't fire on your own convoy, and don't fire unless fired upon.
It's like being plunged into a life-size video game. No matter how prepared you think you are, once the mission starts, the realism is mesmerizing. Produced by an orchestra of projectors, flat screens, cables, and computers. So vivid, you're almost hypnotized by the desire to stay alive in the game. To shoot, to kill, to win. It's a huge adrenaline rush.
Travis, would you like to comment?
Yeah, two things. I love the part. It's like, so you step in here, you give us your name, your phone number, your address, and how you think you're going to pay for college, and then you can step in and play the game. Which, the other thing I have to say is, like, obviously, it's horrifying to, have these children, these baby-faced children take up guns and then, climb all over a Humvee and then enjoy shooting people. But with the explicit intention of hopefully later recruiting them into the military. But also, the game itself looks pretty cool. They're all taking positions along this vehicle, and they sort of the surround sound, the surround sort of like vision, all the projectors and stuff that sort of portrayed the action. I mean, for its day, it does look pretty awesome. Unfortunately.
Yeah. So it is a life-size Humvee, and there are about five huge, like, LCD panels that sort of create, like, a 180-degree screen around the Humvee. And the guns have some kind of sensor on them so that when you shoot them, it correlates to wherever you're aiming on screen and you can interact with it. There's a shot in that news story of like a 13-year-old girl, like, whose shoulder is just, like, you know, jutting with the recoil of this, like, large machine gun as she fires a terrorist out of this Humvee. It's fucking wild.
Rules of engagement are awesome because it's like, we're going to teach kids to shoot people nice in other countries, not the bad way that the other countries do. The noble American way.
After completing the mission, players are then led into a debriefing room where another Army official breaks down their performance and how they can improve. When I was watching this, I was thinking that this is just like a hell house, but instead of Jesus being the answer, it's just war. Oddly enough, this is a pretty good transition into my next segment. So as you can imagine, there have been hundreds of communities that have sprung up around the game. Some are military veterans who actually have military-style rankings within the community where they organize matches and adhere to strict codes of conduct while playing the game and participating in community forums. According to one user, they resent being called a clan. Quote, "We're not a clan. We are a unit. We use the U.S. military as the model for our organizational structure. Individuals have different ranks, and with those ranks comes responsibility in assisting and running the team. A clan is a loose affiliation of similar individuals, a family. A unit is where people from all walks of life come together to accomplish something through cooperation, communication, and teamwork," end quote. And then there are other communities like the, quote, "Drunk with Guns" clan, who are primarily civilians who just love to roleplay as military personnel. Apparently, this is somewhat of an issue within the overall community, as many people in the game will pretend to have had actual military experience using jargon they learned online or in movies. But the group I was most interested in goes by the clan name Men of God Squad. Now, the Men of God Squad is a group of evangelical Christians whose primary goal is to proselytize to people on their team while they play online shooting
God
games.
God damn it, it's a recruitment within a recruitment!
Yes, here's from the FAQ portion of their website. Quote, "Men of God International is an online community of men, women, and children with one purpose, and that is to win souls for Jesus through a unique and growing population of online gaming. Online gaming is the largest and fastest growing community in the world today. In one game alone, there are over 400,000 players at any one given time, day or night. At present, Men of God is occupying is a crazy fucking word to use there, five such games, and is finding great success in sharing the love of Jesus Christ to people all over the world. Some of the games we play are typically something that you would not think of, yet the population in these games are staggering, and the fields of lost souls are ready for harvest. You are Christians and you play war games. Why? To us, it's just a PC game and nothing more than that. There are some that would like to make more of it, but to us, it's just a game. No more, no less. We have fun playing, but most of all, we love the fellowship we have with each other and sharing our faith and love of Jesus Christ. May God bless you richly, General Lord Soldier.
Fuck, man. Signed, Mike Flynn.
Well, the group was founded by a pastor, and apparently on the America's Army section of their website was a giant picture of Jesus looking over the steel support remains of the Twin Towers.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Their now defunct page has the typical characteristics of a gamer clan site, but with a weird, like, hyper-Christian edge. They would hold Bible study groups on FPS voice comm software, create original Christian music for the website, and offer links to other various Christian-themed organizations. The group is a familiar blend of military fantasy mixed with strong evangelical ideology, and keep in mind, this is in the early 2000s. And then, of course, there are the America's Army official forums themselves. There was heavy debate amongst the higher-ups whether posts could be deleted or censored, as gamers have a tendency to use official forums for, well, you know. The Army officials decided that limiting speech on the forums was anti-American and could potentially turn off young gamers who they desperately wanted to recruit. From Lee's paper.
Furthermore, Wilson argued that strict discourse management would especially alienate young gamers who would not be used to the hierarchical aspects of the Army life world. Quote, "You're trying to get people fired up about being in the Army. What image are they going to have of the Army? Is it going to be their disciplinarian father who says, 'Don't say that'? Or is it going to be your teacher, your mentor, your coach? Who lets you say the N-word? moreover, it would miss an opportunity to consolidate the sense of belonging the game project could foster through the community." Wilson suggested that the wrong way of approaching the gamer community was to assume that it was characterized by teenagers who were lazy slackers with no goals in life. He argued instead that, quote, "the right way is that there are a number of different ways that you can make them feel part of the game. It's that sense of ownership we're trying to promote."
This was put to the test when Jack Thompson, a lawyer for engaging in class action lawsuits against game developers for promoting violence, went on ABC News and told people to boycott the game. This resulted in hundreds of negative comments on ABC's website, as well as death threats aimed at both Thompson and news anchor Peter Jennings.
Amazing. The fans are like the most toxic, of course. That's so funny.
Thompson himself created an account on the America's Army's forum to post this, and I quote, "What you do not have the right to do is send me emails and threaten to harm me and my family, as many of you have done. That is not a particularly American thing to do. It is something one would expect of Al-Qaeda, and those of you who have done it are terrorists in every sense of the word. The Army removed the clear threats against ABC's news anchor Peter Jennings from this site. The Army's failure to do the same regarding me assures, one, that this site is in more trouble than it would otherwise be, and two, that Congress will be interested in seeing that the Army facilitates physical and other threats against its critics as a matter of course."
Oh my God, the N-word saying caliphate has like risen up and is already starting to cause problems in the land.
"The Army and the Defense Department have a very long history of conducting unethical, illegal experiments upon soldiers and civilians. This quote-unquote game is yet another experiment upon the unsuspecting pawns who play it. You are the latest guinea pigs. The guinea pigs have been trained to threaten people like me. You have taken the bait."
Damn. My man is straight up saying the Army's toxic because, like, someone wrote that, like, his wife was ugly or something on a forum.
Mm-hmm.
This is already online, like, mod wars and shit.
Yeah. Now, don't worry, this event had literally no effect on the game's growth or popularity, and the game continued to be successful for over 20 years, reaching 20 million total players. In fact, one of the players interviewed for Zon Lee's thesis claimed the negative ABC report actually inspired him to go home and download the game. Quote, "I was at a bar, and we saw a news story about America's Army on ABC, slamming it for the violence in today's youth. I went home and downloaded the game immediately. In all honesty, I wanted to get a feel of why ABC News was slamming it for violence in today's youth. I've always been in opposition of that idea. Another thing about it that I liked was how ABC said the weaponry was more realistic than any other game out there on the market.
My God. Any news is good news.
Eventually, in 2013, the United States Army released a new version of the game titled America's Army Proving Grounds, which as of this writing is due to be shut down today, Saturday, March 5th, which is good timing, I guess, on my part.
They won't even give us one last weekend?
I downloaded and played the game for a little bit, and honestly, it's pretty good. I sucked at it, but the community seemed incredibly supportive, and strangers actually attempted to heal me after I died, which is more than I can say in almost every other shooter I've played recently.
Key phrase there, heal me after I died.
I just pulled a nerve
in
my neck.
Jake's like, yeah, this guy's healing me. He seems to just kind of be dropping his balls onto my face over and over, kind of popping in and out of a crouch. He's healing me.
Of course, the Army won't ever reveal their official stats on the game, but a 2008 report by MIT found that nearly 30% of people ages 16 to 24 had a more favorable view of the U.S. Army solely based on their experience with the game. Anecdotally, recruitment officers have also claimed the game has a positive impact on recruitment. This is from the Washington Post article.
Sergeant First Class Bo Scott, recruiting station commander in Newport News, Virginia, said he was able to meet 70 people at a recent tournament he sponsored with a local college. Out of the group, one video gamer has already enlisted through his office, and another has contacted him about signing up.
If I had to make an assumption, I'm going to assume that the military would not have funded the game for over 20 years if it wasn't creating a significant return in recruitment opportunities. In Lee's paper, he interviewed a handful of players in dedicated clans to get their perspective on whether the game actually eased them into the idea of getting off their couch and enlisting, and whether or not the start of the Second Gulf War had transformed how they looked at the game. One player from the Drunks with Guns clan had this to say.
The war has only affected me in the way that I want to play more. I guess it's an adrenaline thing. Watching the war and then playing AA? Yeah. I feel better every time I kill the Op 4 in the desert insurgent camp level now. It also made me wish I was shooting at the French since they had opposed the war. With the current war, in a sadistic sort of way, there is an irony about the desert scenarios. I'm sure that is unintentional with the current situation in Iraq. He wants to kill the French for not joining in on Iraq, man. America has had such cool war takes for so long. The freedom fries, and now we're going to pour out the vodka, and everything's good.
Another gamer from the same clan explained to the researcher that the cross-section of the war and his disappointment with his clan's commitment inspired him to actually enlist in the military for real. Quote, I was playing about 8 hours a day. I was psyched to play this one level called Weapons Cache because we had practiced forever on it. Nobody showed but me. I was so fucking pissed to this day, I can't believe how mad I was. The thought in my mind was, there would be no way in hell would they do this in the Army. From that moment on, I played less AA and started looking for more info on the real Army. After all the wins and victories I had, I didn't feel as good when around people who were veterans and when I said, yeah, I'm so good at this Army game, and they just look at you like, motherfucker, it's just a game. I actually sat back and said, I know I can do this in real life.
Holy fucking shit, man. This is like manifesto shit, dude. A lot of this stuff. Then I wanted to shoot the French. Then I was like, wait, some guy at a party said, you're just playing a fucking game. And I was like, well, oh, you want to see if I can fucking kill people? Well, then I will, I guess.
The same player also talked about how the game began to meld with the news coverage of the war he had been playing on his television in the background. When the news reported the capture of American POWs in 2003, the player, who remained anonymous in the paper, said he began to play the game differently, trying to more closely simulate events that were actually taking place in real life. Quote, well, I stuck to the hostage rescue missions. The new map, Radio Tower, which involves the rescue of hostages, was almost a real-life scenario of what was going on over in Baghdad. And if I told you how much I played that scenario over and over, I think you would puke or say, get a life, ha ha ha. On average, I was playing 8 hours a day after coming home from work, all the while CNN was on.
Man, That's what they call the multi-screen experience, man. You know, this is good stuff.
Yeah, it's like you've got the news coverage on that is like hyping you up about the war, and then you're going and simulating these moments in the game. I mean, you can see it. Like, I can just imagine it in my head, like what this guy's apartment looked like or bedroom.
You know what? I think the conspiracy theorists are right. We are in 1984. They're correct, actually.
In 2008, Paxton Galvanic of North Carolina claimed that because of medic training he learned in America's Army, he was able to provide medical support to passengers of a flipped-over SUV. The news was covered in a 2008 Wired magazine article written by Ernest Cavalli, who quoted Galvanic saying, quote, "I have received no prior medical training and can honestly say that because of the training and presentations within America's Army, I was able to help and possibly save the injured men."
I mean, I relate because I only drove much later in life, but like definitely playing video games had prepared me for, you know, the kind of...
Some of it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I had to be better than in GTA because GTA, you're always hitting... I'm always hitting poles and shit and taking out people.
People, you know.
I feel bad. I'm one of those players who like accidentally takes out a bunch of people and I'm like, God damn, three people lost their life on my way to this mission.
Yeah, well, you know, most of my sort of like gaming experience comes from Battlefield. So, you know, I came across an injured man. I tried to zap him with a defibrillator. It did not help him one bit.
It did nothing for him.
Imagine being a soldier and you're just watching some guy approach with like a handheld defibrillator when you just got shot in the gut. You're like, no, please. No, Travis, no.
Because I was in charge of this episode, and because it centered around video games, I thought maybe we would end the horrors of the Army's propaganda video game with something a little less frightening, a different sort of game, and a different sort of main character. So please join me in this dramatic reading of
Elden Pillow.
Mike Lindell kissed his children goodnight. He offered a silent prayer and then closed their bedroom door quietly, making sure not to wake them. He yawned as he sauntered into the large master bedroom of his palatial mansion. He was exhausted. He had been on the phone all day with people who used to be his friends, now turned enemies, arguing about how best to save this flailing democracy. He walked around the bedroom, saying goodnight to all of the various products he had invented. Since his wife now slept in a different room due to Mike's night terrors / visions from God, he had surrounded himself with objects made out of various foams and plastics.
Come on.
Oh, this was a late one. Yeah. I barely remember writing this. Oh,
this
no.
This is special.
All right.
Good night, my pillow. Good night, my slippers. A good night, mattress topper. And good night, children's pillowcase scriptures.
He crossed over to the closet and changed into his MyPillow bathrobe before laying in the center of the bed, hands folded over his chest. As soon as he closed his eyes, Mike heard an intense whooshing sound. He knew that this meant a vision from God was coming, and not a minute too late either. Mike was in need of a miracle. Donald Trump wouldn't return his calls, he was millions in debt, and Mike Flynn had left him on red for the last 27 days. Mike glanced over at the large cutout of himself standing motionless in the corner of the bedroom. Its cardboard edges were crumpled and torn. And the cutout itself seemed to be sagging from the weight of Lindell's own failures. God had spoken to him before, and it made him a millionaire. Perhaps, just maybe, he could do it again. Mike opened his eyes and found himself in a very ungodly place. A dank dungeon with vines creeping through each and every crack. Mike wandered, afraid, up the large stone steps and out into the light. The sky was beautiful and gray. A massive stone castle loomed in the distance. A withered old woman was perched on a stone fence a couple of yards away. Mike approached her.
How are you doing? I'm Mike Lindell, here to see the Almighty Lord, and oh boy, do I have some amazing products to tell him about this evening.
The woman glanced up with hollow eyes and a slithering voice. She spoke so softly, Mike could barely hear her above the loud gusts of wind.
Ah, I see another tarnished, yes? Come to seek the power of the Elden Ring.
Mike seemed confused.
Tarnished? No, ma'am. I am a clean... Tarnished? No, ma'am. I am clean and showered and have kissed both my children goodnight.
The woman ignored him.
And what's this? Ah, I see you've come to free the lost souls with a common weapon. No matter.
Mike glanced down in his hand. A wrinkly, ill-shaped MyPillow was crumpled in his right hand.
It will suit you for now, but be warned, Tarnished. Those that plague the land between have far more powerful weapons and a desire to extinguish thy flame.
Mike started to get bored.
Yeah, okay, I'm not sure about any of that, but I do see a gentleman over there on a horse that looks like the kind of fella who might be able to direct another fella to God's great kingdom. God bless, and don't forget to sign up at MyPillow.com, promo code AmericasPillow, okay?
The woman vanished into a thousand specks of dust as Mike ran across a large gray field, waving his arms at a large knight who approached him on horseback, weapon raised.
Ah, what a beautiful animal, Mike said.
Ah, this story will be funny for like four people. That's okay.
Back to basics.
Ah, what a beautiful animal, Mike stated. You know, my kid loves horses, just absolutely adores them. She's always saying, hey, Dad, can you get me a horse for my 11th birthday? I don't know, maybe you know a guy.
With a swooping strike of a large golden axe, Mike Lindell felt his molecules disintegrating. He was surprised then when just a few seconds later, he materialized in the same dungeon where his hallucination had begun. He held his pillow tight and trotted back out in the direction of the knight, who was now casually patrolling a small section of the hill.
Look, mister, I think you and I got started off on the wrong foot. I'm Mike Lindell, CEO and founder of MyPillow.
The knight swung his axe again, but this time, Mike instinctively dodged. He got up, wiped the grass off his pillow, becoming annoyed.
Now look here, pal. Just because these pillows are completely washing machine safe doesn't give you the right to just go around gussying them up, if you know what I mean.
The knight's giant mare reared up on its hind legs, its teeth gnashing, its front legs kicking wildly in the air. As it slammed down, Mike was just barely able to roll out of the way.
All right, mister, I've had just about enough of your braggadocio, okay?
Mike swung his arm back and landed a heavy hit from his MyPillow on the rear of the horse. It had little to no effect. The knight barely flinched as it raised its axe and once again evaporated Mike's body. He awoke again in the same dungeon.
What in the Claire's Boutique is going on here?
He yelled. He again emerged from the dungeon, but this time, as soon as he spied the knight crossing over the crest of the hill, he took off running in the opposite direction. As he ran, he cried out to the Lord.
God, it's me, Mike Lindell, founder and CEO of MyPillow. I'm not sure what you're trying to tell me, but the archangel guarding your fortress is a real meanie, I tell ya.
Just then, four undead corpses lunged out at him from a hidden patch of bushes.
Holy smokes! Mike swung his pillow wildly. Back off! Take that! Go to hell, you son of a bitch!
Before long, each corpse had evaporated into the same twinkly dust. Mike began to worry. Undead corpses? Dying over and over again? No God in sight? No new product ideas? Maybe it was he who had been sent to hell.
Oh no, that's it, isn't it? I died in my sleep from heartburn and I've been sent to hell, is that right?
Mike looked up forlornly at the sky. It was getting darker, and Mike could hear the howl of terrifying creatures off in the distance. He ran, terrified, across barren roads and rotting churches.
Oh God, oh no, this is not good.
Off in the distance, he noticed a small beacon of light with iridescent wisps trailing around it.
Okay, floating crystal, good enough, let's go there,
Mike whispered to himself. As he ran, Mike noticed something. His chest was glowing.
Oh, not the heartburn again. Oh God, I've truly been forsaken.
A young woman's voice shook him out of his panic.
I see thou art tarnished.
Her voice was gentle and soothing. She was seated near the glowing crystal, delicately gesturing to it.
Sit by the light of the grace. I see you carry the runes of those lost, perished at the hand of thy steel.
Mike glanced down at his pillow. It was covered with zombie goo.
Okay, but don't worry, it's 100% machine washable.
The woman continued.
I pray, tarnished, touch the light of the grace and imbue thy soul with the strength of the ancient ones.
Mike slowly approached the crystal, reaching out his hand, fully expecting to be vaporized. But something strange happened. No sooner had he touched the glowing crystal, a menu with various numbers appeared in front of him.
Now hold on a second, Okay, let's see. I got about 10 points in strength. That seems good. 2 points in intelligence. Not true. 60 points in faith. By the way, going down by the second if I have to stay here any longer.
The woman reached out and held his hand delicately. Her grip was ice cold.
Use the power of the runes to aid in thy journey, Tarnished. And perhaps one day thou might hold the power of the Elden Ring.
And then she vanished. Mike spent the next hour hemming and hawing over which area to place his one stat point in. He pored over the tiniest change in numbers, debating which attribute might give him a fighting chance against the knight. Mike waved his hand over the floating letters reading Dexterity. As the runes enveloped his soul, binding to every receptor in his body, Mike swore he could hear mocking laughter emanating from within the crystal. He shook it off. It was time to do battle. Mike strolled confidently back to the hill where the large golden knight was waiting for him.
Okay, pal, it's you and me. My pillow or no pillow, I'm on a mission to talk to God, and I'll be damned if I let you get in my way.
The knight charged, axe raised. So did Lindell. The two raced towards one another across the field. As the gigantic knight swung his axe, Mike hit the ground, rolling through the attack. He spun around quickly and landed a hard blow to one of the horse's legs. The horse staggered back a little. The knight looked surprised.
Let's do this,
Mike yelled confidently, just as a lunge from the knight vaporized him for the third time.
Motherfucker,
Lindell sighed as he felt all happiness leave his body. When Mike opened his eyes, he expected to be once again in the familiar dungeon, but something was different. Mike was standing in front of the glowing crystal where the woman was sitting just a few minutes ago. He noticed now that on the ground were two glowing symbols written in what could only be the language of God or Satan, depending on where Mike thought he was. Mike stood next to the symbols and hovered his hand over them. Suddenly, almost innately, Mike could read the glowing text carved deep into the stone. They were names.
Sydney, Lawyer of Chaos, okay.
He hovered his hand over the other stone. A name appeared.
Michael the Archangel,
The glowing intensified. It burned hot in Lindell's eyes, which he shielded as two amber-colored spirits arose from the stones. The woman was wearing nothing but a tattered loincloth, with a torn piece of magical parchment gripped in her hand. The man, however, was donning a large teapot and used the severed head of a frog as a helmet. The two spirits bowed to Lindell. Mike glanced off in the distance. He could just make out the golden knight prancing across the shadowy hill, taunting him, begging him to fight once more. A look of determination crept across Lindell's battle-worn face.
Well, what are we waiting for? Let's go get my frickin' soul back.
The trio charged off the cursed plains of the land between, ready to do battle with the castle's guardian and hopefully receive the coveted inventor's scroll upon his defeat. Sadly, however, Mike Lindell appeared, alone, once again, at the floating crystal, about 45 seconds later. To be continued.
So there's going to be multiple Mike Lindell Elden Ring stories?
Yes, this is kicking off a whole new series.
Okay.
Mike Lindell, Michael Flynn, and Sidney Powell are traversing the lands of the in-between, fighting various demons on a quest to win an invention from God. So, really excited about it.
It's amazing stuff. I don't mean to disparage.
Thanks for listening to another premium episode of the QAnon Anonymous podcast. Your support helps us stay advertising-free and editorially independent. We have a website. That's QAnonAnonymous.com.
Tarnished, until next week, may the deep dish bless you and keep you.
It's not a conspiracy. Yeah, it's fact.
And now, today's auto-cue. All right,
go through the door. Go, go, go. All right, to the left.
You look like you're really into this. You guys want a real challenge?
As a soldier in the United States Army, you'll find out what you're really made of and how far you can go. Explore over 150 careers, help pay for college, and learn if you qualify for an enlistment bonus. Call 1-888-395-ARMY now for a free copy of the America's Army Game and this new interactive DVD. Hear what it's like to be a soldier from real soldiers.
You ready to take this to the next level?
Call now to find out how you too can become Army Strong.